Friends, it seems as if humanity is taking two different directions, indicating two possibilities open to the human consciousness. There is the direction which is clearly the investigation of the universe, which is the thrust of science at its best. Not only is it an investigation of the facts of the universe, but also a discovery, bit by bit, of the nature of the universe, the principles and laws embodied in the universe, in its very structure. Dr. Chandrasekhar, the late Dr. Chandrasekhar of the Chicago University, who was one of the recipients of the Nobel Prize, mentions in his lectures or in his book on truth and beauty that one of the first things to note is that these investigations are pointing out that the same principles are at work at the minute level as well as at the great level of the stellar bodies, their movements, and so on. The discoveries made by Brown, who was a biologist, botanist perhaps, about the movements of minute particles, finds its correspondence in the movement of distant stars. This is just an example of how they are discovering, or the human mind is discovering, the wonderful order. For if the same principles are at work everywhere, it means that there is a design. And there is an intelligence from which the design has come, emanated rather. Perhaps the universe itself is of the nature of intelligence, as some have speculated. And there is a discussion among the more daring of these investigators about whether they can come into contact with the mind of God. Of course, there are others who rebel against the word God, but if from their point of view the word signifies this universal intelligence which seems to have brought forth an extraordinary order covering immeasurable areas and fields, levels of existence. If they want to call it God, it has a very different meaning from what the average person things the word connotes. But it does not matter what it is called. The fact is that the human mind is probing into the nature of existence and discovering not only this order about which ancient people spoke. For we must remember that the Hindus spoke about a universal order which regulates everything. They called it a Rita. In other ancient traditions, they said, as above, so below. They knew that the same principles are at work everywhere. They did not use the methods of science, but through finding fact after fact, the consciousness of the modern human being is coming to realize the truth, which perhaps was known in ancient times through other means. But not only are the discoveries about this vast, all-pervading order, about all the intricacies and subtleties contained in that word, but also they are recognizing the great beauty in the whole of the manifested worlds. The order itself is beauty, but there is beauty everywhere in the structure of the tiniest of things, in the construction of the shell, in the thread that the spider weaves. There are qualities which the human being is trying to understand and which he copies. And they are beginning to recognize that in nature there was already a creator, an architect, a constructor, if one likes to call it, who was able to produce what until now humanity has not yet discovered. There is beauty, there is order, there is strength in the substances. They say there is nothing to equal the horn of the rhinoceros or the shell of the tortoise or the tensile strength of the spider's thread. But there is also a closeness, a kinship between all things, a mutuality which has come upon the discoverers as an astounding truth. Now, this is a subject in itself, but I mention it only to point out that one direction in which the human consciousness is moving is this direction which unfolds before that consciousness the extraordinary mystery, the depth, the subtlety, the values which exist. And the more that is discovered, the greater the mystery appears. So what is behind all that? What kind of intelligence or power? No one knows. The other direction the human consciousness is taking is, we may say, in the opposite, is the opposite direction. What we have speaking about unfolds, as we said, an order which appears to be divine, an intelligence which has no limit either to what it can embrace or the subtlety of its operations. So there is that movement of the human consciousness towards the vastness, the mystery, and the divinity of the universe. And there is the other movement, which alas is almost too perceptible. That is towards depravity, cruelty, greed, selfishness of an extraordinary kind. It would be trite to say that humanity is at the crossroads, but the trite is the true very often. And which road is humanity is going to take, we do not know. What will be the future? We see everywhere how the immediately profitable becomes more important than anything else. There are many nations which lament the fact that wars break out. We have seen in the last few years terrible destruction, not only in the much publicized Bosnian affair, but in the hardly known civil wars of Angola, of Namibia, the tragedy in Rwanda, and various other places. But who is supplying the arms and feverishly manufacturing more and more deadly weapons? People are coldly discussing whether it is better not, whether it is better to blind the enemy soldiers with the laser weapons which are now available, rather than kill them. For when one man is blinded, two others may be needed to help him out of the battlefield, to take him to the hospital, and for the rest of his life, he will have to be looked after. The logistical facts stare them in the eye, that the resources will be diverted to all the people who will be blinded, while one man killed is only one man lost or destroyed. This is the world in which we live, the other direction we are speaking about. It is, I would like to give you a little bit of statistics. In the last one decade, according to the report of UNICEF, the UN Children's Organization, 2 million children have been killed in one decade. 4 to 5 million have been disabled. 12 million have been made homeless. 1 million orphaned or separated from parents. And 10 million traumatized by shells bursting near them or searching for the parents in terrible circumstances or whatever. As I flew over here from Singapore, there was a child sleeping near me, and in the morning the mother had gone to wash, and the child woke up, and in the strange circumstances of the plane failed to find the mother. And she was wild with distress, crying. But we can imagine what happens to these children under conditions of war. And the report also says that hundreds of thousands of children under 16 fought wars in 25 countries of the world. This has become a common feature now because the guns in the present day are so light that children can carry them. They obey without too much questioning. They don't know what they are doing, so they shoot very readily. And they don't complain so much when they are injured. But this is not the only thing that happens to children. The Home Secretary, the United Kingdom, has had to promise, because the problem has become so noticeable, that he will clamp down on sex tourism. That is, traveling around the world in order to exploit children sexually, especially in the poor countries. There is all this cruelty. I was reading an article about what they call ultimate fighting. It can't be called boxing anymore, because the audience takes frenzied pleasure in seeing the damage done without any restraint. And the author of the article, a well-known person, George F. Will, says, as a man is punched to such an extent that his face becomes a pulp, the audience shouts, his tooth went flying up out of the ring. He's going to snap his arm. Ah, he has done it. Swing up to the eye sockets, and so on. And a slow motion camera reproduces all that. And in the spectators, there are children whom the author says, brought by parents who must be cretins. We can speak about so many other things, not only the exploitation of children, but of animals. I was present at a seminar on gene technology and gene transfers, where, with equal heartlessness, scientists pointed out that now, through gene transfers, they convert a pig into a mass of flesh so heavy that it cannot stand on its legs. And they slaughter it before it dies of its own weight. And they are proposing, through gene transfer, to produce a new kind of fowl, chicken or whatever it is, without the useless wings and legs and beaks and tails, which will be fed by a tube, drained by another tube, but which will produce what human beings think they need to eat. So this is the road to what I call depravity. Always wanting more pleasure, something that tastes better, something that is more profitable, frightened at the same time, not wanting to let go of anything. This is the other direction that humanity is taking. One, the royal road to discovery, to understanding of the universe, to harmonizing with the laws of that universe. The other, the road of petty self-aggrandizement, of profit and pleasure. And of course, the search for profit and pleasure results in this highly consumerist, competitive society of ours, where there is ruthlessness and violence. Is it unexpected that there is violence? When we urge everyone to compete more and more. So with these two clear trends, it seems to me, what are the two clear trends? What will the future be? Who can say? There are the gloom and doom people who will say that there is no future. There are also the people who say, I was speaking to one of them the other day, he says, I am an optimist. Neither of them is rational, because it's just a kind of opinion thrown in the air, because we cannot see what the future is going to be. The future doesn't appear on its own. It's not a leap from now to a few years later. There is no such future. As the present is the continuation and the product of the past, so is the future the continuation and the creation of the present. You may all remember the statement that the First World War was meant to be the war to end all wars. An absurd idea, because by releasing extraordinary brutality and violence, these people presumed that they could establish peace. But what happens whenever violence surges up is that there is only more violence. The people who think in terms of violence, and many do, are only creating or working towards a future in which there will be violence. They often ask, if the enemy attacks, should I not kill him? If the burglar enters my house and there's danger to my family, should I not use violence? But there is no enemy, there is no burglar. The mind is already thinking about using violence, imagining some cause for it, when there is none. So, what we have at present is the result of all the accumulated aggression, cruelty, love of pleasure, avidity of the human mind. And what will the future be? The future obviously will be what is begun and continued from now. So the past runs into the present into the future, and if we are to know the real answer to the question, what is the future of humanity, we must give attention to the present. Action can only be in the present. It can't be in the future. When we think of the past doesn't exist. It only exists in the form of memory or the printed word. But the actual past is gone forever. The future doesn't exist either, except as a projection from the brains of various people. Only the present exists. And in that present, action has to be taken, which either ensures the right kind of future, that is, real progress, evolution of the human qualities of humanity, not the devilish qualities, or perhaps we can go further and say the divine possibilities of the human consciousness, and not the elements which bring about depravity and retrogression. The action must be such that it brings about the right kind of future. And that future is being decided every moment by every person, because there is no humanity in the mass. It consists of all of us. As the UN preamble to the UN declaration said long ago, war begins in the minds of men, human beings. Everything begins in the minds of human beings, which means in the minds of each one of us, in the heart. So it is not possible to be in a state of indecision. Perhaps some of you are familiar with the Bhagavad Gita, the well-known Hindu scripture, where the principal character, Arjuna, is stationed between two vast armies, and he is in a state of indecision. His charioteer is the divine Krishna. It is an allegory, of course. On the one hand, there are the forces directed by the divine energy, which is represented by Krishna. On the other hand, there are the familiar faces and forces of the opposite army. And because they are familiar, that is the pattern in which Arjuna had operated all that time, he feels faint-hearted. How can he shake off that which he is accustomed to? He says, they are all related to me. So are all these energies with which we are faced, related to us. We are familiar with cruelties, with fears, with mistrust and suspicion, the divisions we create between each other, so familiar that we would hesitate perhaps to throw the whole thing to the winds and be in totally unknown, unfamiliar circumstances. This was the dilemma which faced Arjuna when he heard what is called the Lord's song. And of course, it is in 18 chapters, but the essence of it is that the divine voice says that everything in the universe is one. Humanity is one. Not only humanity, but all the earth. The fragrance of the earth is the divine. Sri Krishna says, it is me. The brilliance of the fire is me. The heart of all things, it is me. That means the one great life, the sacred and the divine. That is all, everything is part of that. And those who go towards destruction act as if that is not the fact. That is, where egocentricity, conceit and pride, and if you are interested, you can read the description in the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where there is a wonderful description of the demonical energies which are dragging human beings and humanity in another direction. And it is said that there are these two energies, the divine and the demonic. And in which direction are we going? To find that out, we have to stop and give attention. We means not somebody out there, but every one of us, because we constitute humanity, each one of us. And every present moment offers a situation in which we proceed one step further in that direction or in this direction. Every person is shaping humanity's future. I don't think I am exaggerating. But the first thing one has to give attention to in the present is this fact, that what each one of us does is decisive in a certain way for the whole of humanity. And every moment presents a turning point. And it is for each one of us to attend closely to find out what direction to take in that situation, whatever the situation may be. And again, the Bhagavad Gita says, don't give attention to the result, which is what we are busily engaged with most of the time, because that is a distraction, an escape. The entire attention must be given to the here and now, the quality of what is taking place both outside and inside in our consciousness. Is it in the direction of the divine possibilities, or is it in the direction of more and more demoniacal action? And of course, the human mind is made in such a way that it has immense possibilities. It seems as if the human mind can go very far discovering what is in nature, in the universe, what underlies it, the forces at work and the principles, as we said, and laws. It seems to have almost boundless potential for discovery, but it also has an extraordinary capacity to go the other way. No animal is as cruel as the human being is. No animal is greedy for unnecessary things as the human being is, because of the nature of the mind. We won't discuss it just now. And if we come to the teachings of the wisest people the earth has seen, we will find that all of them really come to this question of giving attention to the nature of our action. If there are commandments which Jesus Christ gave, they are not merely do's and don'ts. The first of them, I believe, is do not kill. Unfortunately, nobody has listened to that, apparently, because there is no addition to it which says do not kill other human beings. It just says do not kill. It is because of ignoring that fact that we have taken the course of widespread destruction of all creatures, so much so that our own habitat is endangered, polluted. But every religion, every great teacher has said this, do not kill. The Buddha's first instruction to lay people was do no hurt or injury to any creature. For, obviously, if the consciousness begins to be aware of the order in the universe, then in that order, everything has a place and everything has a significance, not necessarily by itself. It's like a piece of music where one note which is wrong can mar the music as a whole. But the note by itself does not make the music. It has its importance and its significance as part of the whole. And it is not for one part of it to decide that the other has no value and therefore is destructible, which is what the human being has decided. And no teacher advised that, because every wise person knew that the all of existence, life, is a whole. You cannot injure another without injuring the whole, which means injuring yourself, oneself. And examining various teachings, one will find that the reference is to this unity and wholeness of life. And that is the clue, perhaps, to all action. We are faced with numerous situations in life, some of them challenging, some of them appearing not to challenge. When we feel there is a threat, it is very likely that it is a threat to our sense of separateness and nothing more. These are not the real challenges. Historians have pointed out that whole civilizations have perished because of not realizing where the challenge lay for them. Sometimes they were looking outside while the challenge was within. And similarly, we may believe that there is a challenge, a threat to our person, and miss giving attention to our own response. How is one acting? Is it in a way which expands the human consciousness towards the universe as a whole, unifies it with that vast existence of which every person is a part, or is it a contraction into egoism, which is retrogressed? In the beautiful little theosophical classic at the feet of the master, the question is raised, not the question, the statement, yes, the question is asked, will you work for evolution or for selfishness? We may not connect the evolution of humanity with the question of individual selfishness, but all selfishness, all selfish response, self-centered response, self-preoccupation is a point against evolution. It is a step which is retrogressive. So we have to ask ourselves in various situations, what is the response? And this was what the Divine Krishna pointed out in a variety of ways to Arjuna, who is on the battlefield. And each one of us is on that battlefield, of which is our own consciousness. We have to decide whether we are helping to go in this direction or in the other, which means we must ask ourselves, are we expanding in consciousness and kinship and harmony, or are we contracting into selfishness? Now, to many, statements like love alone can end hatred. Hatred does not cease through hatred. Seems impractical. They say we cannot survive upon this earth if we are not selfish. We have to compete if we are business people. And that is where, that is how we are creating an extremely insecure earth. If everyone is competing, everyone practices selfishness because he cannot survive, humanity itself may not survive. It may destroy itself. even if it survives physically, it may cease to be humanity because the human qualities are not there. It is not humane humanity. It will be some kind of a devilish humanity. So if humanity is to survive, then we have to consider what is really in favor of evolution. And there is no tit for tat in this, because tit for tat only makes for more rapid progress along the same lines. If the other person is greedy, I have to be more greedy. Keep up with the Joneses, it's called. If the other person is violent, I have to retaliate. What else can I do? And so on. And if that is what we are practicing, even in small ways, with our neighbors, with our friend, within our community, we are working for a dark future for humanity. But if we can act in a truly religious way, then it means that one does not practice retaliation. One has to do the right thing because it is right. Right in itself, right for humanity as a whole, right because it preserves the great order of the universe, and not do otherwise because the other person is doing that. That would be very childish, because children like to do what the other child does. But we have to be grown-up adults and act thoughtfully, reflectively. So every situation in life calls for a certain amount of contemplation. And that contemplation must lead to action. It is a question of giving attention in the day after day to the direction in which we are moving. And if we reflect over all this, then perhaps we can decide now what the future of humanity will be. Not only decide, but we will be initiating that movement which will end in a good future, a future which is perhaps a divine future. Madame Blavatsky and others too. Madame Blavatsky was one of the two founders of the Theosophical Society, spoke about the divine man and the animal man. In each of us, the two possibilities are there, the two energies are there. So it is not in some dramatic moment that we are going to prove ourselves and allow the divine possibility within us to emerge. But it is in daily action, in the innumerable situations with which we are faced, that the divine energy is released. So if someone speaks harshly to us, how do we respond? Do we retaliate? Do we feel angry? If we do not obtain what another one has, do we feel envious? Do we feel a certain resentment towards the other? J. Krishnamurti, a very distinguished philosopher, said, "Can you look at a person in a beautiful, expensive car, going past, enjoying driving that car, and not feel any envy? Enjoy it with him, looking at him." So, what is our response to all these situations? That is the important question we have to ask and answer rightly in the perspective of the directions which we may find. I personally feel these are the two directions. You may perhaps look at it differently, but the whole question requires a great deal of reflection and meditation And accordingly, we have to give action, attention to the action which we perform today. If we have to eat something, what is the result? What is that product which we are eating, the result of? Is it the result of the bestiality of the human being who has converted a pig into what the scientist calls the flesh bag? If we have to get into a plane, are we unnecessarily competing when there is no need for competition? Because competition has become a habit. Perhaps you have noticed that passengers who have boarding cards and who have their seats all allocated still rush forward as if their life depends on getting in first. Why? Because we do not reflect, we don't give attention to the moment. So there are a variety of things. It's not in the dramatic moments that we shall transcend this dark element in ourselves. It is through daily practice, living a life of thoughtfulness and of action which represents that thoughtfulness, that the future of humanity will be decided. It won't be decided by the politicians, the people who seem to be important. They may take decisions of various kinds, but as you know, humanity has gone on in the same way. Somebody quoted the last 2 days that human society has not changed for millennia. The same prejudice, the same unwillingness to leave habitual patterns and take up new attitudes, they continue. So we may act according to habit, but unless we give attention to the question. So the future is not decided by politicians and people who seem to take the decisions. It will be decided by how every one of us in every part of the earth acts day by day in relationship to the many things, joyful as well as painful. And in each of them there is right action. And for that right action, one must be harmonized inside. And to be harmonized is to be in a state of yoga. And the whole of the Bhagavad Gita says, be harmonized and act. Don't bother about the result. The result will take care of itself if the condition within you is right.
If there are a few questions that we could have, try to make them reasonably brief and questions rather than statements. And we can draw a little further on her wisdom.
So, I thought about this thing about order in the universe. And
speak out a little bit.
This thing about order in the universe and whatever that's above is below. But in some ways, are we not looking at a reflection of ourselves? Because if the mind orders, then obviously we don't see the world as it is. But we see the world as we are. And the other thing is this thing about the macrocosm and microcosm. It's as if the man was in the DNA, and the DNA is in the man. If you stood on an electron, or a small subatomic particle, and looked at me, what you may see is the same as what I would see if I was standing out and looking into the universe. And clusters of stars would be like a Milky Way. My bones would form clusters of stars, and so on. So it's all right to say that, yes, there must be something that's divine out there, but it's still, we're looking at things that's transcendent instead of immanent. And what do you think of this order as really looking at ourselves?
I think that's leading the witness.
I don't consider myself qualified to discuss this kind of question. I am not a scientist, but the important point is not whether what I said is correct or not correct, but the fact that the human consciousness is made in such a way and has such capacities that it is investigating, it is probing, it is questioning what is order. Is there order in the universe? It is trying to see relationships, understand the design, the beauty. It seems to have infinite possibilities. If we look back into history, study the mystics, not only the scientists, and all that the human mind has speculated upon. So that is the main point that I wish to make, not this as incidental. But actually, if the order is not there, but it is just a reflection of what one thinks, the Platonists would have asked, why does the very word order mean something to the human consciousness? There must be something in the universe that corresponds to this concept. Otherwise, the concept couldn't arise in the human consciousness. Let us not forget that human consciousness is part of the whole. Dr. Ananda Kumara Swami, who was a very well-known writer on sub-art and philosophy, he pointed out that beauty as a value exists only for the human being, as a value. Beauty exists everywhere. When the lamb gambols on the meadow, it's very lovely. But the lamb cannot know what is beauty, so far as we realize. It is only the human consciousness which questions what this is, gives it a name, knows beauty as a value. So the human consciousness is constituted in a very special kind of a way. And therefore it has great possibilities, either this way or that way.
If in the process of evolution we are moving progressively, why then do we say that humanity has not changed?
First of all, evolution takes place on a vast time scale. So even a few centuries or millennia may not show a perceptible change. There may be changes, but you see that aggression and violence have been part of human society and human life in all the civilizations, all the ages. It is coming to a head now because of the kind of knowledge and weapons humanity has. But the trends are the same. So, in a certain, it's a way of speaking, we must recognize the fact that greed or anger or selfishness is not something new. It has always existed. And it continues. Which doesn't mean that evolution doesn't take place. We may destroy all of ourselves, perhaps evolution will still take place. We can blow up this whole of the earth, but evolution may go on. Perhaps evolution is not so dependent on us as we think it is.
Ooh, this is a sad thought. Sellers for thought. Speaker, Mrs. Rada Bernier, our international president, is an infinitely tolerant person, and anyone who wishes to discuss some of these matters further with her, I know that she will be very patient and very helpful, and it will prove very fruitful if anyone wishes to approach her. She is really a quiet and unassuming person, but very approachable. But anyway, in my satchel I have a quotation by chance that I put there, and effectively it indicated that one should only refer to the past to make a point and then move on and deal with the present. And our speaker tonight very effectively did just that. And from many very sound points, very important points made upon which we should all ponder with further consideration, I felt that it was particularly valued to hear Radha say, the future is not a leap from now to some unspecified time ahead of us. And later, she, in summing up, made it very clear it is how we act day by day. And I suppose if we only remember that, and I feel sure we will remember much more and be caused to think very deeply, but that in itself would certainly, I feel, would be a great deal for us to assimilate and act upon. So I am thanking Mrs. Radha Bernier on your behalf. I would just like to say how deeply we appreciate your speaking with us on this subject, and I would ask you all to join with me in giving some indication of our appreciation.